Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, Episode 14, Acoustics and Psychoacoustics of Speakers. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. My guest geek of the week is Floyd Toole, retired Vice President of Acoustical Engineering at Harman International and author of the book Sound Reproduction, The Acoustics and Psychoacoustics of Loudspeakers and Rooms. Hey, Floyd, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
I'm glad to have you on. We've known each other for a number of years, and I visited you out at Harman a number of times and always had a great time there, very informative. So really happy to have you with us today.
Good.
I wanted to start, this book that you've written is fascinating. I've gotten through a fair chunk of it so far.
Yeah, it's heavy going.
It's heavy going. It's chock full of great information, but it takes a while to digest. It's really the culmination of your life's work, isn't it?
It sure is, yes.
Yeah. So give us a bit of background, if you would, in terms of you started working at the National Research Council of Canada before you were at Harman. What were you doing there?
I was a research scientist. I had just graduated with my PhD in electrical engineering. And while doing that, I focused in the area of psychoacoustics, as a matter of fact, applying engineering techniques to understanding how we perceive direction and space, how two ears and a brain combine two channels of information to a unified view of the world. It was interesting stuff. The problem back then was that many people who were investigating that topic area came from the psychology end of things and did not appreciate signal processing and the stuff that you could do with electronics, and I did. And so I combined my skills and knowledge of electronics with some psychoacoustics and actually did some useful work. So when I went to the National Research Council, I intended to continue with that sound localization research because they had I used headphones in my doctoral work. The anechoic chamber at the National Research Council was the attraction, and I thought I would move from headphones into an anechoic space and then eventually to a more reflective normal room. The missing ingredient when I got to start the experiments was a good loudspeaker. And somehow in my naivety, this would be an easy thing, and it wasn't at all. And when we started looking at the sort of high-end loudspeakers of that era, they weren't flat and smooth and neutral at all. And so there began the work that ended up occupying all of my life. So I've spent my entire life in scientific research, in acoustics, in audio.
Mm-hmm. And that led you ultimately, when you got to Harman, I think, to develop the multi-channel listening lab.
That was one of our tools, yes. We were fortunate enough to be working for, I went from the Canadian government to a large industrial bureaucracy, and I can tell you there's not a lot of difference. I mean nothing negative about Harman, because Harman treated me and my research group very, very well indeed. It's just that they had more money to spend on this than the Canadian government did. And so we were well treated to the facilities that the engineers needed to design products and the facilities that we needed to evaluate those products. So we had technical evaluation equipment on one side and subjective evaluation equipment on the other. And the MLL, the listening lab, was part of the subjective, of course.
Well, I'd like to get more into the listening lab in a moment. But first, I was particularly struck by, at the very beginning of your book, is a section called Philosophical Perspectives. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to get your hit on that. In particular, live versus recorded music. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I was amazed to see in your book quotes or references anyway to Glenn Gould, the famous pianist, and Igor Stravinsky, both of whom thought that recorded music was likely to be the death of live performance.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's funny, you know. Well, my perspective is totally that of a listener to live sound and reproduced sound. I'm a lousy musician, but I love music. And you know, but you talk to musicians, the creators, and you get a sometimes surprisingly different perspective on things. Mm-hmm. And Glenn Gould is on record many times saying that while he, you know, he did public performances, he didn't enjoy them because in his view he never got any performance perfectly correct. He always screwed up in some large or small way, and if he
which
were in
probably
a recording
no one else would know, but
probably not, but you know, it bothered him to the point where towards the end of his life he avoided live performance and spent days in recording studios editing the smallest details of his recordings.
And yet, there is a distinct difference, difficult to quantify perhaps, between listening to live music and listening to perhaps a recorded version of the same piece. Say, you go, John Atkinson, the editor of Stereophile, conducted an interesting experiment where they had a pianist in a room who played a concert, which John recorded on very high-end equipment with very high-end microphones and so on, and then played it back for the same audience in the same room. He close mic'd the piano, so there wasn't a lot of room sound in the recording, and then played it back on very high-end equipment, and there was still something different between the two. I'm convinced that there's really no way to make a recorded piece indistinguishable from a live performance.
Yes, in fact, I address that in the book. I don't know whether you read that part of it.
I did.
Yet, but it's impossible. The recording does not, the recording with some number of microphones cannot capture the full three-dimensional sound field. Mm-hmm. And some number of loudspeakers that we would consider to be practical, 2 or 5 or 7 or 10 even, that's still not enough to reconstruct a full three-dimensional sound field. And so we're not capturing it at the beginning and we're not reproducing it at the end. And so there is simply no missing ingredient, no hidden tweak that we can apply to our playback gear that will allow us to experience the real thing. And that's that's precisely why I still go to the LA Philharmonic at Disney Hall and go to jazz clubs to experience real musicians performing, because that's the treat. And what we hear through loudspeakers at home ain't shabby, but it's not the real thing, nor can it's. But yeah, it provides clues to the real thing, and you know, we have very active imaginations, and our minds fill in a lot of the gaps that are really missing in the recordings. But and the end result, of course, as we know, is highly entertaining. I mean, it's excellent, frankly, but it's not real, and nor can it be.
It's not the same thing. It's a different experience, is what you're saying.
Yeah, the sounds that arrive at our ears at home are not at all like the sounds that would arrive at our ears in a concert hall or a jazz club or rock concert. Name your venue.
Mm-hmm. Now, why is that? Why is it that this, aside from the perhaps intangible effects, I'm asking really more about the room.
Well, actually, it is the room. The room is part of it. The room, in the first instance, the room as a recording environment. And you used the example of a piano. A piano is a very large musical instrument. I mean, it's several feet in any dimension. It radiates sound in all directions from all of its surfaces. Now, nobody can tell me that a single microphone or 2 or even 3 or 4 or 5 microphones can capture all of the sound that radiates from that piano. Yet, if we were sitting in a room, the studio or hall, concert hall, performance venue, with that piano, we would hear all of those sounds, some direct to our ears from the piano, others reflected off the floor, the ceiling, and the walls, and yet others that hang around in the form of reverberation. And it's all of those together that give us the impression of the piano. Now, if we play back that whatever the microphones picked up, which is just a sample of what was repeated by the piano, and we play them back through, let's say, two loudspeakers in stereo, and these loudspeakers are not omnidirectional. They radiate fairly directly towards us, and, you know, wide dispersion, bouncing off floors and ceiling, floor, ceiling, and walls, and so on. But that's not what we would have heard from a piano in that room, or any room. Mm-hmm. So it's just different. The sounds that are at our ears in a playback of a recording are different from the sounds in a live performance, and that's why they don't sound alike. They can't mm-hmm. sound alike. It's not possible.
Now, you mentioned you did mention the word omnidirectional, and that made me think. I wonder, have you done much work with omnidirectional speakers? I know there are such things.
Yes, over the years, we've encountered a few of them. There aren't many, and we've encountered a good sampling of them. Mm-hmm. There's nothing particularly right or particularly wrong with a directional loudspeaker. It's mm-hmm. When I said omnidirectional in the case of the piano, or if the loudspeaker is reproducing the piano radiates sound in all directions, but it's not omnidirectional in the sense that it radiates equally in all directions.
Yes, of course.
That's the fundamental difference. The bass notes go down towards the floor a lot, and the higher frequency notes bounce off the tilted top and into the audience area and so on.
Sure.
But so far as when you come to reproduce it, an omnidirectional loudspeaker, if it's a good one, it sounds fine. I mean, it is a viable alternative technology to reproduce a sound field in a small room. Given that the sound field that we're going to reproduce is not the sound field that we might like it to be, it is a legitimate variation on the theme.
Right. So how would you characterize the difference, the acoustical difference between a large room and a small room? Typically, sound is reproduced, for consumers anyway, in a relatively small room, certainly compared to a concert hall or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so there are plenty of ways, I'm sure, to characterize that difference and how to approach the issue of, well, okay, if the sound isn't the same coming off of a recording as opposed to live, how can we make it as good as it can be?
Yeah. Well, I point this out in the book, too, pointing out that we have to just sort of abandon all hope of reproducing a duplicate of the sound field around our head in a domestic listening room. That can't happen. We could do a better job through headphones, as a matter of fact, than through loudspeakers. That's called binaural recording.
Sure.
And a good binaural recording can be very satisfying. The problem is that when you turn your head, the concert hall moves with you, and you end up with the orchestra inside your head. Now, there are modern-day techniques that allow us to generate a more externalized image, but you know, that's off topic for this discussion.
Sure.
If we're going to do it with loudspeakers, we have to consider what the objective is. The objective is, I believe, to reproduce the essential perceptual dimensions. I mean, the first dimension is direction. Where is the music coming from? Mm-hmm. So you point to the front, basically, where the band is and mm-hmm. the orchestra is, and you point left to the violins and right to the cellos, perhaps, if it's an symphony orchestra. And you then have a sense, you also, on top of that, have a sense of distance, how far away this is. Is it all coming at you from loudspeakers that are 8 or 10 feet from you, or is there in fact a sense that maybe that orchestra is really quite a good deal further away. That's an important ingredient. So we have the sound stage, if you like, the sense of direction and distance. Then we have the sense of envelopment, of being in the room in which the performance is occurring. This is a perception that we take very much for granted in a concert space, but yet it is when scientists have spent decades examining what it is that makes a good concert hall sound good, it turns out to be a very impressive sense of envelopment. The fact that when you're sitting there, you feel that you are sharing the same space with the orchestra. And this has been the main missing ingredient in reproduced sound over the years, because with monophonic reproduction, you can deliver no sense of this whatsoever. With stereo, you can get a hint of it, mostly sort of in the frontal hemisphere, but not very much to the side and behind you. If it happens, it's almost accidental. But with multi-channel sound, you can generate as much of it as you like, whenever you like, and you can turn it up and turn it down, turn it on, turn it off. And so multi-channel audio is really a major step forward in the sense of delivering what is regarded by listeners to be one of the major ingredients of a good concert hall. Now, concert halls imply high culture music and, 5% of the listening public or less. And so, what about rock and roll and what about movies? Well, it turns out that this sense of envelopment is important there too. And all popular music, a high percentage of popular music incorporate signal processing to give you a sense of an acoustical setting within which the music is taking place. Mm-hmm. And in a movie, in fact, the movies, of course, as we know, introduced us to both stereo and multi-channel audio, God bless them. and in the very beginning, when they had a limited number of channels to work with, it wasn't so much gunshots and ricochets or explosions coming in, flyovers and so on, that they were looking for. It was a sense of envelopment. It mm-hmm. was to give the people in the audience the impression that they were in the space that is being portrayed on the screen, that they were sharing that acoustical space with the artists, with the performers.
Mm-hmm.
And so, envelopment is so if we're going to try to reproduce sound in a way that conveys the essential qualities of live performance, where they may be, sharing the space with the performers is a big part of that. And once you're able to do that, which you can with a good multi-channel audio system, then you can put yourself in a car, you can put yourself in somebody's living room or a jazz club or a concert hall or a gymnasium. I mean, it's all possible, and we all experience it now. The one thing about small rooms, home theaters, as opposed to large rooms, is that a small room with a multi-channel audio system can be made to sound as large as you like. But a large room can never be made to sound small.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that before.
And that's one of the limitations of cinemas. And I'm aware of this, of course, because I spent my life listening to and for these things. And I go to a cinema, and what I have to get over, adapt to, because humans adapt. We can listen to these things and hear them, and then in a few minutes it seems to go away and don't listen anymore. Well, one of the things I notice is that I'm in a big room, and if somebody is talking to me on screen and it's obviously a close mic'd, perhaps dialogue replaced text that they're talking, they're speaking, it sounds like somebody talking at me through a big room. It's not intimate. Lovers cannot whisper sweet nothings into each other, in such a space and get away with it. Whereas at home, I do get that impression.
Right. That's right. Or you can reproduce the impression of being in a large or even open space.
Oh, that's right. At home, you can do it all. In a big room, you can't.
Go ahead.
Yeah, just not as persuasively, that's all.
And I was going to say, and yet,
small rooms, as most of us have, certainly as a home theater, do have problems of their own in terms of room modes and standing waves and so on.
Right. Good point. And in fact, that is the second, the first impression difference between a large room and a small room is the sense of space. Mm-hmm. The second is what happens in the bass. Space and bass.
Space and bass.
Space and bass, yeah. And in a large room, the bass, the resonant frequencies are so low that they're in a concert hall, they're off the bottom of the scale. Mm. So in a concert hall, you get good bass almost wherever you sit. At home, you certainly do not. The bass in a small room changes from place to place and from room to room. And I don't know whether you got to chapter 13 in my book, but it's there that I deal with this topic. It is the missing ingredient in home listening, and that is the dual problems. The bass is not smooth, flat, and neutral anywhere, and it changes from seat to seat. So we want. First of all, we'd like to be able to share the experience, not just have, you sit here and I'll sit there, and I'm just not going to tell you that there sounds really good, and where I put you to sit is so-so. it would be nice if we could share it with among two people or more, between two people and among more, but the reality hasn't been possible until now, until very recently, and I explain in chapter 13 precisely, how we now understand the phenomena of standing waves in small rooms to such an extent that by using multiple subwoofers, just two or four in a rectangular room, we can get very consistent sound over quite a large portion of the listening area without any fancy signal manipulation. We may want to do some equalization, but by the time you've deployed the two or four loudspeakers in their correct locations, the need for equalization has been significantly reduced. Then there's the other technique, which is sound field management, in which we actually use two or three or four loudspeakers, subwoofers located at different in different locations in the room. And this room can be anything. It can be any shape, L-shaped, X-shaped, it doesn't matter. and with that technique, you do some measurements and do a little signal processing. And as if by magic, you can afterwards just pick a sample of bass guitar and kick drum and put it in a little loop or walk around the room, and the bass does not change. I mean, very, very subtle changes at most, whereas previously you were finding places where there was only one note bass and other places where the bass seemed to disappear or chunks have disappeared. So we're much better off now than we used to be.
Science is good. I like it too. I'm very happy about science. Yes. Yeah. How did you come upon the use of two or four subwoofers? Let's start with a rectangular room. And where are they placed?
Well, how it began, it's, how necessity is the mother of invention. Somebody
always
said that. and it happened that in my own home, I had two listening spaces. I had a home theater, multi-channel home theater, and I had a big living room, dining room combination. It was the largest volume I could afford to build back in 1975. It was my closest approximation to a concert hall because at that time, 1975, we only had stereo really, and I had concluded well before that stereo could not deliver the full impression of space and envelopment.
Did you ever experiment with quadraphonic?
Oh yes. Well, that was a little technical misstep, unfortunately. It was also a business misstep. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was ill-conceived, let's just say, because if you're going to have four channels, they put them in the wrong places, and then they missed the opportunity to give customers the greatest blessing of all, and that is to eliminate the need for a stereo seat by putting a center channel in there. Mm. And if you have a center channel, you have a left and a center, and a soundstage then is uniform across the whole front. I mean, at least you have three real sources of sound, and the need for phantoms is significantly reduced. Because phantom images do not sound like real images, like real loudspeakers. And so
there are a number of people I've talked to who say they prefer a phantom center to a real center, and I've never understood why.
Nor I. They obviously are not hearing what I'm hearing, and not measuring what I'm measuring, because, you know, you can measure it, you can hear it. It's very well known among people who have played with this game. I grew up with stereo, so I've spent 50 years with it, and I'm sick and tired of it, frankly. It's time to move on. If anybody thinks that stereo is a superior form of sound reproduction, they are simply ignorant of the facts.
Those will be fighting words for somebody, I'm sure.
Good, that's fine. I mean, I don't mind a good argument. Read the book, and then we'll discuss it. But, you know, don't just get emotional and say, well, I've had my crank turned so many times by stereo that you can't say that. Well, my crank has been turned too. I'm just saying that the cranks could have been turned a lot faster, better, and, you know, the rewards could have been considerably greater through a multi-channel audio system had we had it.
Right. Which we sort of did with quadraphonic, but as you say, it was kind of a misstep. And went back to stereo for a while, and now we have 5.1 and 7.1 and so on.
Well, quadraphonics was, in fact, like double stereo. Stereo up front and stereo behind you. And so the sweet spot then was constrained not only left and right, it was constrained front to back.
There was really one sweet spot.
There absolutely was. I mean, in stereo, at least you can get a stereo stepladder kind of going, yeah, you know, with people behind each other. But with quadraphonics, that was just not an option. And, you know, for the solo listener, it occasionally provided a decent image. But even then, we now know that there's a better way. And as I said before, you know, the fact that there was no center channel kind of just missed the whole point.
So getting back to the question I posed a moment ago regarding subwoofer placement, you had your own need there.
Oh, yes.
In your house.
Yeah, well, the continuation of that story is that there was a horrendous boom in the home theater room. And I thought of equalizing it, and I tried equalizing it, and it kind of worked, but it could only make it work at one seat. And I could make it sound good for me, but whoever else was in the room suffered. They actually didn't improve things at all, or it made things worse. And so I did not consider that to be a very gratifying solution. And as I thought about what physically was going on in that room sound field, it came to me that if I used two subwoofers, I could, in fact, and placed them judiciously, I could actually cancel, that is to say, not excite that particular room resonance. And I did it, and by God, it worked. The bass was nice and tight and clean, and I didn't use an equalizer, and I measured it before, and you get this horrendous peak. You listen to it, and the kick drum booms ferociously. You do it afterwards, and there's no peak that you measure at all. It's nice and smooth, and you play the kick drum, and it just hits you in the gut. It's nice and tight and clean, and bass guitar riffs are all there. All the notes are there, and I say, my God, this is a neat trick. This is mode canceling. And
now, how does that work? I mean, the two subs are both pumping energy into the room.
That's right. And, well, it's hard to do without an illustration, Scott.
Okay. All right.
But if you consider that if this were the room, I'll get my hands in the picture here. If this were the room left to right, at the first standing wave. The sound here is loud. The sound here is loud. But
that's,
in the middle,
that's at the walls.
At the walls, but in the middle, halfway between the walls, the sound goes away at that particular frequency.
Yes.
So, at any instant in time, the sound at each at the two walls is opposite in polarity. That is to say, when the sound is going up on one side, it's going down on the other. And so it's seesawing like this, up and down, up and down. My video is a little jumpy, but let's just see. You know, so it's going up and down.
Right.
If you hook up two subwoofers and put them in phase and put them at the walls, then they are both going up and down together.
Of course.
They are destructively driving that room resonance, that mode.
Mm-hmm.
And it ceases to be excited. It's just not there.
Gotcha.
It can't exist because the woofers won't allow it to exist. And it's interesting. And the other thing you can do is, if you have only a single subwoofer, is to move it to the center location, put it in the null. And then
put it in the middle of the room, in other words.
Put it in the middle of the room. But it could be at the end of the room, at the wall. Put it in the middle of the wall, and then you can not excite that particular mode through a different mechanism. So we now have two techniques for preventing bothersome resonances from being excited. And one is to cancel them so that they're just not, no energy, no useful energy is transferred to the mode. Mm-hmm. And the other is to drive it at the null, in which case, for a different reason, no energy is delivered to the mode. So combining those two ideas and thinking that in a home theater-sized room, in the frequency range of the subwoofer, say below 80 hertz, there are only a small number of resonances. There are only a small number of resonances that can possibly exist.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, a young man who worked for me, had Todd Welty, who had considerable MATLAB skills, and I just put him to work on this. I said, Todd, it seems to me that there is a recipe here. If we do an analysis of possible loud subwoofer numbers and positions, that would allow us to eliminate most, if not all, of these new bothersome resonances in the subwoofer frequency range. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it is possible. It is possible.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. But it's even if you can't employ the technique that gets rid of all of the resonances, there are positional combinations like four subwoofers, one in each corner, or two subwoofers mid-wall front and back, or two subwoofers mid-wall side to side. Those three configurations end up eliminating most of the bothersome standing waves, not all of them, but the ones that are left are relatively easy to work around, so that you know where the problem areas are going to be. You simply then try to not put people in those locations. There's a good large area within which you can work, and within which most of the listeners will hear very similar bass. And this is a huge improvement over the bad old days of yesterday.
I'm surprised to hear you say you could put the four subwoofers in the corners, because I've always thought that putting a subwoofer in the corner, tends to amplify certain frequencies quite a bit. And
yeah, in fact, it does, and it amplifies potentially all frequencies, and that's a good thing. It makes your subwoofer way more efficient. So you get basically free sound out of it.
But would you do that? Would you put one subwoofer in the corner?
Actually, if that is your situation, if you're one subwoofer and one listener, I would indeed start with the corner and see what I get. Because if I get lucky, then, and it sounds good in the sweet spot, then I just leave it alone take the acoustical efficiency gain and smile about it. If it's boomy, then I've got a little trial and error chore ahead of me of moving it and listening, moving it and listening, moving it and listening. And by, if you're lucky, you'll find a place that's reasonably good. In any room that I've ever encountered, I'd have to say that equalization at low frequencies always improves the bass quality. But with a single subwoofer, it only works predictably at one location. The advantage of
one seating location, you mean?
One seating location, that's right. Mm-hmm. The advantage of subwoofer solutions is that it can work similarly well at a number of seating locations. You can share the good bass.
Mm-hmm. What about if you have two subwoofers, placing one at the midpoint on, say, the side wall and one at the midpoint on the front or back wall? Does that give you any advantage?
It doesn't work in the way that you'd like to think it would. If you put four of them and put each of the four in a mid-wall location, that also works very well in that it produces a good uniform sound field for many listeners. The problem with that configuration is that it is very, very inefficient. And in essence, you're putting four 15-inch subwoofers in there with 1,000-watt amplifiers, and the amount of bass you're getting is more like four 10-inch subwoofers with 300-watt amplifiers. Oh. And there's no profit in that. The corner locations can give you actually significantly more power.
Mm.
And in fact, if you use the corner locations in a rectangular room, you'll find that whereas you might have started off thinking you needed 15-inch subwoofers, you probably can get away with smaller ones.
Ah, interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Okay, so what about the second approach, which you called sound field management?
Sound field management is considerably more complicated because it requires transfer function measurements, that is to say both amplitude and phase or impulse response measurements, from each subwoofer location to each listener location. And once the data is accumulated and stored in a laptop bearing the appropriate software, the software then goes to work on it and comes up with the signal processing that is needed for each of the subwoofer channels. And in the, these are things that you can introduce manually if you have the signal processors available, or if as is done now these days, the computer will simply download the coefficients to the signal processor, and it's all done for you. But the upshot of that is that the four subwoofers, whereas the multiple subwoofers in the rectangular room solutions need to be identical, these need not be identical.
Mm.
And what's fascinating about it is to just look at the adjustments that it calls for to improve the bass. And always, in every solution I've ever seen, some of the subwoofer channels are down anywhere between 6 and 12 dB. I mean, it's huge. That is to say, the subwoofers that previously would be working full tilt are actually turned down and are loafing. And yet, in spite of that, counterintuitively, the sound pressure goes up.
And this is, you're talking about corner placement here?
No, this can be, and you don't have to use corner locations.
This is with the sound field.
Sound field management, yeah.
Management,
yeah.
Yes. Okay, so but that requires more sophisticated technology. You need a computer, you need DSP.
Yes, it's a proprietary solution, and the only product it's in at the moment is JBL Synthesis.
Ah, which is the very high-end JBL home
right.
theater system. Yeah,
that's right.
So getting back to mere mortals, one subwoofer maybe in the corner might do well in one listening location. Multiple subwoofers, two on the mid-wall positions facing each other or in the center of the room. Multiple subwoofers not in the center of the room. One in the center of the room might do something good. But, you know.
There is, by the way, Scott, there is such a thing as near-field subwoofing.
And, oh, yeah?
And, I actually lived with this for a very short period of my life. I put the subwoofer. I was in a family room situation where the wall behind the sweet spot was the end of the family room. It jumped up 2 feet to the kitchen dinette. And in that little jump behind my, immediately behind my chair, I cut a hole through the wall into the basement and inserted it, an 18-inch subwoofer without an enclosure. And it kicked serious butt, literally. the beauty of it was I was so close to the subwoofer that the effect of the standing waves in the room were really significantly diminished. You were just because you're so close to it.
Right. All you're hearing is the direct sound from the subwoofer. You're not really hearing reflections from the wall and therefore not the standing waves.
Yeah, you got it. That's right.
Wow. Huh. So here's a good idea for a new product. Somebody could build a home theater chair with a subwoofer built into it.
Well, they do the vibration ones now, so they just...
Yes, they do. There's Clark Synthesis and Butt Kicker, and those things make me sick, literally. I mean, I'm not trying to to diss them or anything, but I actually get nauseous when I'm sitting in one of those motion simulator butt kicker type chairs.
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose the same thing would happen with a subwoofer.
I don't get sick. The few times I've experienced them, I find them almost amusing. But anyway... they don't bring me closer to the real experience, let's say.
Yes, exactly. They might even, in fact, take you out of it by being a little distracting. It certainly would be for me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a personal thing, though.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, so we've got placement. I was going to ask you what you think of the technique for finding subwoofer locations, which has been called, among other things, the subwoofer crawl. Are you familiar with that?
Where you put the subwoofer in your listening location and go crawling around the room. Yeah, that's fine. Reciprocity. It works.
It works. Okay, good.
Yeah. And in fact, this is a case where, you know, as I said to you, if you have only a single subwoofer, you know, just for the hell of it, start with it in the corner and see what it sounds like. Because if it will work there, then you're getting a lot more bass for nothing. But if it doesn't work there, then you've got to move it. And so you can then swap positions with the subwoofer and do the crawl.
right. Put the subwoofer in your listening position and then crawl around the room, around the periphery of the room, typically, right?
Yeah, that's right.
To find the place where the bass sounds the smoothest and the least boomy and so on. This, though, gets into the whole question of room dimensions. And let's assume a rectangular room. Do you have an idea or an opinion about the most optimum dimensions in a room? Some people talk about the golden ratio and some people talk about this and that. Mostly people say, no, a cubicle room would be a very bad idea.
Well, here's an interesting surprise. I'll shock you again.
Please.
If you use multiple subwoofers or bass management, the sound field management, not bass management, sound field management.
Sound field management, yeah.
One or the other. Square room is just fine because you're canceling the modes anyway.
So it really doesn't matter. That's fabulous.
Well, it doesn't matter if, and big if, you're using the right combination of subwoofers and locations. Mm-hmm. In general, though, of course, it's a shape to avoid, as are long, narrow rooms and L-shaped rooms and things like that. Mm-hmm. But the reality of life is that we end up with houses that have such rooms. I mean, my own room is almost square. I mean, it's 1 foot difference between its width and its length, and that was not by my design or intentions, but that's just the way it is. Turns out it doesn't matter because I have multiple subwoofers. And
how many do you have? Four subs in there?
I have four, yeah, and it's fine. I mean, there is no audible or measurable bass anomaly that is associated with the fact that the room is essentially square.
One point I wanted to get into. Sorry, go ahead.
No, it's all. It's just interesting that you know. Oh, yeah. But the rest of that story of optimum of golden ratios and ideal rooms is that it all began in the 1950s when scientists, real acousticians, physical scientists, were designing reverberation chambers where they would measure the sound power output from noise-making machinery and devices, appliances and the like. And in order to get a uniformly diffuse sound field that was uniform at all frequencies, down to low frequencies especially, the choice of dimensions of the chamber mattered. And so they argued back and forth about which set of magic dimensions gave the most satisfactory result for acoustical measurements. Had nothing to do with listening rooms. It was later that other people came along and in their naivety said, oh, well, if it's good for this purpose, it's got to be good for this other purpose. Well, the difference is that when you measure the noise output from machinery, you have chosen the location for the machine in the room. There is one place, there's a place where you put the machine. Mm-hmm. And then there are some number of microphones that are located statically or moving around, rotated, so that you sample the sound field. That's not home theater. That's not listening. Because true in enough. Listening, you know, we your room or mine might well have magic dimensions, but in your room you may put your woofers somewhere else, somewhere differently from my choice of locations, and I might choose to sit in a different location. So the only location where the magic room dimensions really appreciated is if the woofer is on the floor in one corner and you stick your head into another tri-corner, I mean, in the room. I mean, that is the assumption, because it assumes that all modes are energized by the woofer. And that only happens at a tri-corner, where the woofer is on the floor in the corner or at the ceiling in a corner.
Right.
And it assumes that you, the listener, are going to hear all of those resonances that are now uniformly distributed. And that only happens if you stuff your head into another tri-corner. Well, I mean, it's so silly, you can roll around on the floor and laugh. But right. for decades, people have just conveniently ignored this fact. The continuation of that story is that once you move the woofer out of a corner location, then it doesn't excite all of the modes. Once you move your head out of the corner location, it doesn't hear all of the modes.
And right.
Longer that your beautifully calculated room resonance distribution is spoiled by the fact that the speakers are not in the right location and you're not in the right location. And then to make it all worse, we have the audacity to add a second loudspeaker called stereo and maybe five or seven called multi-channel, and they all radiate energy into the room at different locations. And so the mathematics by which you chose those wonderful dimensions simply are wrong.
Okay, very good. Okay.
It's interesting. That's not a personal opinion. That's just a fact.
Yeah, no. I understand. I understand. Yeah. I know a lot of people who spend a lot of time designing, you know, building their house from scratch, and they say, "Oh, we want the listening room or the home theater room to have these dimensions because it's going to be the best for resonances and room modes and so on."
Yeah,
but you're saying it's phenomenon. Just not all that important as long as you treat the subwoofers in particular in this way that we've been talking about.
Right. If you go to my book, or if you go to the current CEA, CEDIA standard recommendations for home theater design, mm-hmm. you will find the recipe by which you achieve this. I mean, either using two subwoofers, mid-wall locations, side to side, or front to back, or four subwoofers in the corners. Then, if you do that in a rectangular room, emphasize rectangular room, then the only problematic areas are the 25% distances, at 25% of the distance across the room from each of the walls. So you can just draw a little plan of your room and on this plan draw lines at the 25% distance location and lay out your seats and keep the seats, the heads, listeners' heads, away from those lines.
Mm.
And if you do that, you've really designed your listening space. Now, once you start doing that, depending on how many seats you really want to have in your home theater, how big those seats are, I mean, how closely spaced they are and so on, you might find that, by golly, this would be a lot better if my room were a little longer or a little narrower or a little wider, that kind of thing. And that's, mm-hmm. in that sense, and in that sense only, it can be useful to adjust the room dimensions. And so for a given home theater design, if you're starting with a clean sheet of paper, there can be an optimum room dimension, but it's not the one at all related to the concept that we started this discussion with.
Right, right. What's the problem with the quarter points or the 25% points that you mentioned?
Well, because these subwoofer configurations don't eliminate all of the room resonances. They eliminate most of the bad ones. But the ones that they leave, the residual ones, are always the same. They're always the ones that produce a null at the 25% locations. If you were to the subwoofer locations that convincingly attenuate all of the horizontal room modes are in fact at the 25% locations where these lines cross. That is to say, they're in the middle of the room, and so they're just not. It's not a practical solution. It is actually. I said that. I'll take it back because it is. If you want to put your subwoofers in the ceiling.
Well, I suppose no reason not to, but I suppose it's a relatively rare situation.
Yeah, yeah. I know at least one designer who has actually done it. So,
well, okay. So it's not impossible. Not unheard of.
This is clearly a solution for a custom.
You know, sure.
Clean sheet of paper design with somebody who has some money to spend. This is not a retrofit for. For our homes.
What about the placement of the other speakers? We've been talking a lot about the subs, and I know you've done a lot of work in that realm, but what about placing the front, right, and left, and the surrounds, and the center, for that matter? Center, obviously, is in the center.
Yeah, right. That takes care of itself. You have a choice of putting it above or below the screen or behind the screen if it's perforated.
Mm-hmm.
Those are options, but fortunately, the ventriloquism effect is extremely powerful, and we humans are extremely susceptible to it. When you think about, I've noiselessly by getting up in the middle of a movie and rushing to the loudspeaker to see where the sounds are actually coming from, only to find that much of the time in most of the movies is coming from the center channel. Right. And yet people are wandering all over the wide screen and closing doors and shooting guns and what have you. And yet all of the sound is, in fact, coming from the center loudspeaker. Mm. And we believe in our minds that it's moving around the screen because that's where we see the lips moving. That's where we see the little muzzle blast from the gun and so on. And, we fill in the blanks very, very conveniently. The left and right loudspeakers should be ideally placed somewhere near with the tweeters close to ear level, and either right at the edge of the screen or further apart, preferably, plus or minus 25 or 30 degrees
from the center line.
From the center line, it's a stereo soundstage in essence, with the center channel in there. It's not anything greatly new. Mm-hmm. The side surrounds. If you have a 5.1 channel system, the surround speakers should be located. If you have only two surround channels, then they should be located beside you and slightly behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason to put them slightly behind you is so that you get a suggestion of a rearward location when there's a flyover.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, in fact, from the point of view of creating the sense of space, which is what they do most of the time, they could, in fact, be slightly in front of you. This happened to me in my very first home theater because I really had no other choice. So I said, well, darn it, I'm just going to have to put them ahead of me, and It wasn't the fact that it sounded absolutely fantastic. And so there's an optional range between, you know, roughly in somewhere between plus and minus 60 degrees to plus or minus 120 or so degrees where the side speakers can go. Some people get their knickers in a knot over, you know, whether we're messing with the localization of the sounds that are in the original soundtrack. And I listened to lots of movies, and I never really could convince myself that it mattered a great deal where that gunshot came from. It's whether it's my, you know, 10 degrees behind me or 10 degrees in front of me or what have you. In fact, if you go to a cinema, it can be 10 degrees behind you or 10 degrees in front of you because there are speakers dotted down the sides of the room.
Right. And, but in that case, they're all producing the same signal, aren't they?
I mean, they are indeed. Yeah, they are.
Because those are the side surrounds and they're all producing the same signal. As opposed to the front, right, center, and left behind the screen in the case of a commercial cinema.
That's right. And the one you localize to will probably be the one closest to you.
Because you're getting the direct sound from that one first.
Right, right. And of course, as in a cinema, just as in the home theater, all of this works best if you're in the middle of the room. I mean, if you sit off to the side in a cinema, the surround sound stuff just doesn't work very well. I mean, you localize the loudspeakers just as you do in a home theater. Mm-hmm. Just that in a cinema, because the cinema might be 50 or 60 feet wide, the suite area might be, you know, 10 or 15 feet wide. You get quite a few people in the center of the cinema who actually get a decent sense of envelopment and surround. But in a home theater, you might only get one or two people because it's narrow, so small.
Right, right. How do you respond to Tom Holman's assertion that when talking about 7.1, now we're beyond 5.1, we've got 7.1 with two channels in the back, and Tom says that really that's not as important as having more channels in the front because we tend to be able to localize directionality more precisely in front of us than behind us.
That would be fine if we had the choice of the arbitrary choice for the number of channels. Right now, the use of the additional sixth and seventh channels in his setup is mostly intended, as I've heard it demonstrated, for you know, the reproduction of a classical music experience. And as the target, I would 100% agree with him. And in fact, in my book, I point out that the optimum angle for the side surround loudspeakers, if you want to create a sense of envelopment, is plus or minus 60 degrees. And so it's a scientific fact, not a personal opinion. And so if that's your objective, then that's a very good way to do it. In fact, you don't need side speakers at 90 degrees or 120 degrees. You just need them at plus or minus 60, and you will get a very, very persuasive sense of being in a big room somewhere. I mean, it's excellent.
Because the plus or minus 60 from the front, the center line in front of you is what I believe you're referring to. And that is where Tom places what he calls the width channels.
Yeah, those, I didn't hear him say this, but I would imagine he probably reflections from the sidewalls of a concert hall. And that is, in fact, where that evidence came from. That's where that's what motivated the people to investigate it, because they were trying to determine what it was in the design of a concert hall that made some halls sound spectacularly enveloping and spacious, and other ones not too. And it turns out that it's not the fact that the sound field is diffuse, because, in fact, the sound field isn't totally diffuse, but rather that there are energetic reflected sounds coming at the listeners from about plus or minus 60 degrees on each side, the side walls of the hall. And when that happens, you get this overwhelming sense of envelopment. I mean, I went to a concert couple of concerts at the Musikvereinshall in Vienna, which is regarded by many acousticians as being, you know, one of the paradigm halls in the world. That's one in Amsterdam and one in Boston. And
Concertgebouw in Amsterdam.
That's right. They're all shoebox-sized, shaped halls, and they have this plus or minus 60-degree wall reflection in abundance. And when I went there, when I heard the concert in these hall, in this hall, I was quite taken aback, actually. I thought to myself, if I or any of my hi-fi friends heard a surround sound system that generated this sense of envelopment and spaciousness, we would consider it to be fake. You know, it was... Yeah, it's true. I mean, I grew up or spent most of my time in a fan-shaped hall because, you know, much more modern hall, and the sense of envelopment was, yeah, it's kind of there, but not great. In this case, it was... Yeah, go ahead.
So, sorry, I was going to ask if you had heard anything in Disney Concert Hall.
Yes, I go there, and... I like it, actually. It's a different kind of hall. It's a different kind of
space. I do, too, but it's not it's not a shoebox, certainly.
No, but they've applied the calculations that were in that we learned from the shoebox experience and tried to do the best they could in a hall that would accommodate more people. I mean, this is a battle between the financial people who are trying to balance a budget. And the artists / acousticians who are trying to make really, really good sound and who want really, really good sound.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you want to build a really guaranteed good hall, copy the ones that are good. But then we'd end up with smallish shoebox-sized halls, and it's hard to make money with such small halls. They don't accommodate enough people and so on. So, and you know, architects would go out of business. No, they wouldn't go to business, but their business would be restricted to other types of construction. But, you know, architects love to make different every hall different from every other hall. That's their signature design. And in doing so, unfortunately, they are conducting a hugely expensive acoustical experiment because they don't
always work.
Which
may or may not work.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned one other thing I'd like to get into. You mentioned earlier about diffuse sound fields and so on, and that led me to think about the surround speakers in most home theaters are these dipoles or bipoles, which are intended to create a very diffuse surround sound field. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that you have a different take on that.
Well, let's just say that Tom Holman and I have different opinions on that. And
okay, all right. Well, that's what makes a horse race, you know.
It makes a horse race. That's right. Well, the reality is, as Tom points out, the direction from the optimum direction for reflections for enveloping sound, which is what we're after here, is plus or minus 60 degrees. So I can quote Tom himself.
Sure.
And if you look at the scientific data that portrays the optimum angles from which these reflected sounds should come, they cover the angle from about 45 to 50 degrees through 60 where it's maximum, but tailing off gradually as we go to 90, to 110, to 120 and 30, and then it fades off to nothing at 90 degrees at the back behind us, or 180 degrees behind us. And so we really have quite a broad range of angles, all of them coming from the sides. We want sounds to originate if those sounds are to create in our minds the sense of this beautiful envelopment. The directions that don't work are from the front and from the back, right?
Directly from the front or directly from the back.
That's right.
And you're not going to have envelopment from those frequencies. From those directions.
Right. And if you draw, if you do a little drawing of a room and you put side surround speakers at plus or minus 90 degrees and draw the reflection paths for those sounds, the reflection paths are off the front wall and the back wall. that they're coming from the wrong directions. That's why in their wisdom, the original side, the original surround locations were to the sides of the listeners, not at the front or at the back. The problem that the THX dipole was attempting to solve, well, originally it was combined with the fact that there was only a monophonic surround channel back in the days of Dolby surround.
Sure.
But the second, that went away very quickly, though. That was a passing phase. Immediately after that, people realized that if you were sitting in the center of the room, you get a nice sense of envelopment. But if you moved off to the side, just one seat or two seats away from the center of the room, the sense of envelopment diminished and then went away. And at about the same time, you started to localize where the sound was coming from. It was coming from the side loudspeakers. Now, that's a physical law. You can't avoid that. I mean, it's a fact that it has to do with the inverse square law, the fact that sounds radiated from these loudspeakers fall away at 6 dB per doubling of distance. And when you get closer to them, they very rapidly escalate in sound amplitude. And we localize to them. The frequencies that are most readily localized to are the high frequencies. Mm-hmm. Something that Dolby, way back in the very beginning, realized when they rolled off the surround channels at 7 kilohertz. So you wouldn't localize the sibilant splashes from the dialogue that were...
You're reminding me of this, and I remember that now. I had forgotten completely that originally right. Dolby rolled off above 7K in the surround channel.
That's right, yeah. And it was because in the optical soundtracks that were quite common back in those days, there was leakage of the dialogue from the front channel, from the center front channel especially, from into the surround.
Crosstalk, in other words.
It was crosstalk, and it was sibilant crosstalk. It was S's and F's and P's and T's, those kinds of plosive sounds. They were all high mm-hmm. frequencies. And so it turns out that if you just roll off the high frequencies, you didn't notice them so much, and so you didn't localize. They weren't as annoying. Well, in a very real sense, this is exactly what the dipole does, the THX dipole, because mm-hmm. it's not a dipole at all frequencies. It's a dipole only down to about 500 hertz, mm-hmm. which means that if you're sitting in the null of such a loudspeaker, the high frequencies are attenuated. Those high frequencies are radiated instead towards the front wall and towards the back wall.
From which they are reflected and then reach you from the front or the back.
Yeah, which don't generate envelopment. Another fact to consider is that it's a very common and, I believe, good practice to put absorbing material on the front wall, and it's often, in fact, a ritual recommendation to put absorbing material behind your screen, especially if you're in, which means that those sounds are gone. The front sounds are gone, and right. Normally, if you want to prevent sounds coming from the back front or back wall, you just absorb those. And if you absorb those, if put any absorbing material on the front and back walls, then the dipoles simply don't work in the way that was originally intended. Certainly, not in the way that in any way related to creating a quote unquote diffuse sound field, because such a sound field does not exist in a small, dead room in which we listen to movies.
Mm. So your recommendation is not to use dipoles in the surround positions?
It's hard to say. I mean, you can make your own compromises. First of all, they don't sound very good. In fact, I was talking recently to a manufacturer who has made and continues to make a good deal of money, I'm sure, from selling dipole surround speakers. And I said, you've got to offer the public something, you know, another option. And he said, yes, you're right. He said, but people still keep buying them, even though I do admit they sound funny. Well, if in 2010 the manufacturer is saying that he's making speakers that sound funny, where did all this timbre matching and high quality sound concept go? you know, so anyway, a better solution would be to use a bipole. A bipole is simply a wide dispersion loudspeaker.
And now let's make sure we get the definitions correct here. The dipole is a speaker that fires essentially, more or less, frontward and backward, and the drivers are out of phase with each other?
That's right. That's
and
right.
The bipole is the exact same thing, only the drivers are in phase with each other.
That's right. And if it really becomes a very conventional loudspeaker with unusually wide dispersion, something that you would probably consider advantageous in a home theater where you had several rows of listeners. If you have only a single listener, any loudspeaker will do it. If you have multiple rows of loudspeakers, then you've got to have a speaker with wide enough dispersion to deliver a good, strong, direct sound to all of the listeners in the room, which brings me back to the dipole thing, because the dipole has a single null, and that null is directed at the listeners that are 90 degrees away from it. So in a multi-row home theater, only a single row of listeners can receive any of these supposed benefits, right?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
If you're ahead of it or behind that null, then you're in the direct line of fire from the tweeter anyway. So you're going to be getting direct sound. Yeah,
right.
Whereas anyway, to the extent that it works, or works to the extent that certain people claim it works, it only applies to a single row of listeners.
Whereas a bipole, instead of having a null at the 90-degree orientation from the speaker itself, it has just the sound from both drivers contributing equally.
That's right. They merge, and they're in phase, and so they add as perfectly as it's physically possible for them to. For many home theater applications, even they aren't necessary. Ordinary forward-firing, just wide dispersion forward-firing loudspeakers are enough, especially if you can aim them. I mean, if you can put them on these little pivots and aim them at the listeners. Mm-hmm. But it's something that you can, you know, if you put down a little, get some squared paper out and put your seats in place and just see what kind of angular relationships you're looking at. And that'll tell the difference. Turns out that this the real problem, the crux of the matter, is the inverse square law. The fact that we're so darned close to these side loudspeakers that as we move closer, they get very rapidly louder.
Yes,
and you know, you don't have to go very far away from the center of the room before you localize to the loudspeaker. What I describe in the book is two solutions. One that's out there now but expensive, and that is a line source loudspeaker, which falls away not at 6 dB per doubling of distance, but 3 dB per doubling of distance.
And we should define that as a relatively tall columnar speaker that might be a ribbon, or it might be a bunch of conventional dynamic drivers just stacked one on top of the other. And interestingly, I find this fascinating. The sound level falls off much more gradually than from what we call a point source.
That's right. Have you ever heard one?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Yeah, because you can start at the back of the room and walk towards a real line source, and the sound gets a little bit louder, and all of a sudden you're standing 6 inches in front of it, and it's still not loud.
Not much louder than when you were across the room.
No, it's amazing. And then there's a new kind of a new configuration of loudspeaker called constant beamwidth transducer, which is just now beginning to appear in the marketplace as a professional product. I hold out hope that somebody one day is going to actually make eventually the ideal surround loudspeaker, because these darn things are jaw-droppingly good. They sound good, and you can walk across the room and stand right in front of the darn thing, and it's still not loud. So,
what'd you call it again? Repeat the name, please.
Constant Beamwidth Transducer, CBT. And it's in my book.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. I haven't gotten to that part yet.
Yeah, no, it's further on, yeah. And I show, you know, why it works. And it's just one of these things that causes you to shake your head and say, I would not have thought that possible. Mm. But it is. Mm. Science is good.
Science is good.
Science That's it. Is good. Yeah. Once it works, and if you understand it, you can do it again and again and again.
Well, that leads me to my final question, which is one of the parts of your book that I found most fascinating was the section on predicting listener preferences based upon scientific measurements.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak to that point for a bit?
Well, this is the ultimate goal of any psychoacoustician, and that is to be able to understand what we measure in sufficiently that we can interpret in the set of measurements what we might hear. When I started doing these investigations 35 or so years ago, it seemed almost hopeless because subjective opinions were then regarded, many people still regard them as very highly personal. What you like, I may not like, and that's just where it ends. But it turns out that if you give people an opportunity to form opinions in the absence of biases, which is to say, listening, if you listen to speakers which are hidden behind a curtain, and you listen to two or three or four products, and you switch among them and listen to music and write little notes down, and at the end of the exercise, give me a number on a scale of 10, which you think might represent the excellence of each of these products, where 10 is perfection and 0 is rubbish. It turns out that most people actually agree. And I can tell you that when this first happened, back in the late 60s, early 70s, for me, nobody was more surprised than I. I said, this is amazing. I shook my head and discussed it with my colleagues, and everybody just sort of said, gosh, we would never have thought that. Because in terms of music and food and beverages and people to live with, I mean, we are all wildly different from each other. And everybody thought, well, you know, you've got to pick the loudspeaker that suits you. Well, it turns out that most people, most of the time, chose the same loudspeakers to live with. And from that point on, my work became a lot easier because then I had a reliable database of subjective opinions that I could take back to the lab and compare, to interpret the measurements and to make correlations between various quantities that we would measure and how they related to people's subjective opinions of the product. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, over the years, I and others and Sean Olive, who came to work for me 20-odd years ago back in Canada and who still is at Harman now and after I left even. And he and I did a lot of this work, fundamental work on the audibility of resonances and the audibility of reflections and the importance of on and off axis and on it goes. And to the point where, you know, one day we just said, you know, I think we could put it all together. And Sean did. Interesting little story. It was prompted by an email from the CEO of Harman International, my boss, who said to me, he said, look, Tool, we pay you a lot of money to you know, be sure we make good loudspeakers, and here is this consumer reports issue that shows that other products are rated higher than ours. What's wrong here? Why are we not winning this contest? And I had to back up and tell him this long story about, well, the technique they're using is over 30 years old and it's very primitive and it's flawed in many ways and they really should stop doing it because it doesn't do anybody any favors. It's certainly not the consumers because their ratings don't work with what people hear. And, you know, I've been around the industry a long time and many manufacturers share this opinion. And we kind of laugh it off and say, well, it's only Consumer Reports, you know.
No, nobody, yeah, but a nobody lot would, of people rely on Consumer Reports.
Well, there is the real problem, isn't it? I mean, people
consumers,
do.
I mean. Yeah.
Yes, of course they do. Of course they do. Because and in fact, I do sometimes. I mean, if it depends on what I'm buying. I'll go check out what their findings are. In fact, what I find useful sometimes is just what to look for, even, you know, because they've thought about things. Well, they thought about this back 30-odd years ago, but they haven't thought about it since. And you know, maybe it's time for them to revisit the subject. Yeah. Anyway, I persuaded my boss that we'd look into it. And Sean Olive and I sat down and decided that this was a worthy project that, you know, only good could come from it, but we did much good. And so he developed an algorithm that seemed like a reasonable way to translate the data that was buried in the technical measurements that we were making and to interpret those data in a way that, in different ways, in fact, that would relate to this rating scale of, you know, zero being rubbish and 10 being good. Mm-hmm. And he did it with 70 products, 70 products that we had. Because at Harman, we, you know, you alluded to this listening room. Well, we use that listening room to evaluate our own products and products that we buy from our made by our competitors. Mm-hmm. And ideally, we like to beat the competitors.
Of course.
So we had.
And we should say before we go on as a side note that in the multi-channel listening lab, you place several speakers on platforms, strap them down. The platforms are movable. In fact, they are computer controlled, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
And the position of the four or five speakers behind an acoustically transparent but optically opaque cloth, the positions of the speakers are randomized so that you don't get acclimated to how a particular speaker sounds from a particular location.
Well, it's actually you're close, but not quite right.
Oh, please.
Sorry.
Correct me.
The presentations are randomized. That is, the sequence, the choice of the loudspeakers is not up to either the experimenter or the listener. The choice of music is randomized. But the whole purpose of the shuffler, the speaker mover thing, is in fact the opposite of what you say, to bring all of the products to the same location so that the room is...
Okay.
Yeah, so the room is neutralized.
Okay, so every time you listen to a different speaker, it's in the same location as the one you just listened to.
You bet. That's it.
Okay, all right.
So that the room, whatever it is, and it happens to be a good room, but, you know, it is a room nonetheless, at least it's a constant factor.
Yes.
It is not a variable. The only variable that we're introducing here is the loudspeaker that's in that particular location. Mm-hmm. And you have no idea what it is. You don't know whether it's big and expensive or small and cheap and made by, by Harman or made by one of our competitors. You have no idea. Anyway, the upshot of it all was that we had comprehensive subjective data on these loudspeakers, and we had
70 of them, as you said.
70, yeah. And these were speakers of all sizes, from big floor standers down to little ones you tuck under your arm. And we had full sets of measurements on them. Now, what Sean did then was to use his created algorithm to work on the measurement data to calculate a prediction of a quality rating that would, we hoped, correlate with the real quality rating, the one that matters, what people say.
Yeah, that each of these speakers got.
Yeah, because if people don't like it, then it isn't a good speaker,
right?
Whatever the measurements say. Turns out that the correlation was very high. It was 0.86. One would be perfect. 0.86 is dangerously high. If you go to Las Vegas with odds like that, you'll be thrown out of the casino real fast. So it means that we were certainly on the right track. The one thing that intrigued us was, of course, where this all began with the Consumer Reports rating publication. And so in 70 loudspeaker population were 13 loudspeakers that had been in that Consumer Reports test. And so when he ran the algorithm for those, the correlation was different. It was higher. In fact, it was 0.996. It was one. There was no error at all in the predicted rating and the rating given by people who listen to music through them. And the explanation, we believe, is principally the fact that these were all very similar sized, very similar configuration, small bookshelf loudspeakers.
So and these were speakers that had been in Consumer Reports.
That's right. Yeah. Now the correlation
and that you had also tested.
Yes. That's right. The correlation between the results of our listening tests and the Consumer Reports ranking on their printed page was minus 0.23. minus means that you get a better idea of which speaker might be good by turning the page upside down.
Oh my God.
And 0.23 is a very low correlation, meaning that the numbers are basically pretty random. So it's not very useful information. Now, we knew some of the people at Consumer Reports. In fact, I'd visited there several years before I was at the National Research Council in Canada. They were very hospitable and so on. But they we decided that we better let them know we were, or Sean was going to be publishing, presenting this data at the Audio Engineering Society. You can buy the papers. They're readily available. They're on the Harman website, I think. They were grateful, of course, but disturbed. And there were some contacts. There was some contact between us in the subsequent months and a year or so. The upshot of it all was that they basically stopped doing loudspeaker tests for a while and found somebody to investigate their processes and to upgrade them. And my last contact with them indicated that they weren't able to find the money in time to actually complete the project, but they had moved a significant direction towards the way we were evaluating loudspeakers, and that they felt that things were a lot better than they used to be, and they thanked us very much. So that was gratifying. You know, it's not the perfect solution, but at least I think we've done some good work.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic, and I think we've come to the end of our time. So I want to thank you, Floyd Toole, for being a guest on the show. Your book is available on Amazon.com. I know that since that's where I got it.
Yes, right.
And probably find technical bookstores everywhere.
Well, I don't know about that. It's not a mass market topic. So,
no, true enough. But
unfortunate, as much as you and I might wish it so.
Yes, indeed. And if you want to find out more about Floyd's research with Sean Olive at Harman, I'm sure there's plenty of information at harman.com.
Yes.
My online homes are ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com, and you can email me with questions or suggestions for future podcast guests at scott@twit.tv. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be David Vaughn, movie and product reviewer for UAV and Home Theater, one of my own colleagues, with lots of interesting geeky things to say, I'm sure. So I'm looking forward to that very much, and I sure hope that you tune in with us. Until then, geek out.